Hello and welcome to Making the Rounds, a podcast by the American Medical Association. Today's episode is part of our Health IT series from the AMA MSS Committee on Health Information Technology. My name is Matthew Swanson and I'm a medical student at the Frank H. Netter MD School of Medicine, and I'll be your host for today. Today we're joined by Dr. Anupam Jena, the Ruth L. Newhouse Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Jena.
Thanks for having me.
So to get things started, I wanted to ask, how are you involved in the health IT space and what are you currently working on?
I would say I'm mostly a consumer of health IT. I mean, I think the two places it affects my life, one is as a physician. I work at Mass General Hospital, and so I, you know, obviously use the EHR in clinical work. A lot of the research that I do kind of relies indirectly on components that are in EHRs. I use a lot of insurance claims data for my research, and the reason why is because it's large data. We have pretty rich information on patients, their medical histories, what medications they take, which doctors they see, which hospitals they end up getting hospitalized at if they are hospitalized, and then are often able to link it to outcomes. And some of that data derives from either EHRs themselves or from the billing platforms that are embedded in EHR. So that's kind of the way that aspect of medicine and healthcare touches my life, my professional life.
Yeah. So I can imagine that at least with EHR right now, there's just a lot of data out there. And, you know, I know one of the things you're known for is asking, you know, interesting questions that other people haven't thought of. So to dive a little bit deeper into this, what do you think is the impact of your work?
You know, I kind of think about my work as really kind of bringing together the way that economists think to some of the problems that we see and deal with in healthcare and medicine. I always kind of describe my work as being really just kind of creative and sometimes, to be honest, asking questions that are probably not the most important pressing questions that medicine tackles, but are nonetheless, I think, really interesting and fun and can get people who have either experienced these issues or people who are interested in medicine excited about doing research. And I don't think there need to be 1,000 people like me doing this kind of work. There's a niche that I fill, which is really kind of tackling these quirky and interesting questions using big data and the tools of economics. But I ultimately do the work because I enjoy doing it. It's fun. And the part of the process that I enjoy the most is that creative process of just coming up with ideas. And there's one thing that I could, you know, convey to people who read papers that I write, you know, I think it would be just learn to think a little bit outside the box, because there's a ton of questions that you can answer. Every paper, or most papers, take the same amount of time to write: a creative paper and a not so creative paper, a well done paper, a not so well done paper. They all take time. And so why not try to figure out things that are creative, in the process?
No, definitely. Yeah. It sounds like, you know, something exciting to endeavor towards. You know, this conversation is tailored towards a lot of medical students. So a question that I wanted to ask you is, in pursuing, you know, this, these research objectives, have you encountered any challenges along the way?
I think the biggest challenge is trying to convince people that the type of work that I do has some value, because as I alluded to, a lot of the questions that I explore aren't going to rise to the same level as trying to understand and, you know, decompose and offer solutions to systemic disparities in healthcare. Obviously a super important question. Before we started our interview today, you asked me about a study that we did in the New York Times, which is about how driving behavior responds to Fast and Furious movie releases. And, you know, that's a fun question. I would like to think that the question is not just limited to whether or not Fast and Furious movies have this unintended effect on driving behavior, but maybe as answering a more fundamental question that actually physicians and health policy research think about, which is, what's the impact of media on behavior? I mean, there's like probably hundreds of studies that link video game playing and watching violent movies to certain forms of behavior. None of those studies are causal. We shouldn't really kind of look at them as being causal. And the reason why is that people who play violent video games tend to be different than people who don't. And you don't know that's the video games that are causing a certain behavior that you're studying, as opposed to the underlying characteristics and behaviors of that person in the first place. And so the Fast and Furious study, while it was really fun, and the reason I was attracted to it is because it was fun, I think helps at least propose a way that people who are interested in these questions in the clinical world could use tools from economics. It's a natural experiment. You know, these movies just come out on certain days of the year, and you can look at changes in behavior that is specifically highlighted and glorified by that movie, which is it's about fast driving, not the slow and deliberate driving, right? So you have a very clear prediction about what you'd expect to see. I think that's the biggest challenge that I face.
So, you know, just talking about medical students, a lot of the research and the studies that we see, at least from my perspective, they don't really, for the most part, you don't really come across very many people asking fun and creative questions, questions that, you know, questions that, I don't know how to describe it, but fun questions, I guess. So it's nice to introduce you as someone that, you know, these people exist out there. There's mentors out there. There's people that are asking these questions, and that's something that, you know, medical students can do as well. So another question, you know, it's been a crazy year this past year. Has COVID impacted your work in any way?
No, not at all. Wait, okay. I'm just joking. Yeah, I mean, it certainly impacted my life as long as everybody else's life. I mean, I'm very blessed, and so the impacts on me are much, much smaller than on most others. You know, I have kind of intentionally stayed away from COVID-related research, in part because there's just a flurry of people asking a flurry of questions, and it's hard to rise above the voluminous number of studies that are being performed. We do have a study that we've done on COVID, which is like kind of close to my form of other types of work. And I'm guessing that this study will come out before the podcast or this show is released, so I can disclose it here. The basic idea behind the study was the following: is how do you know whether or not social gatherings, small social gatherings, lead to disease spread? Which is obvious in some sense, because we know how the disease spreads. It spreads by person-to-person contact largely. But how do you quantify exactly how much a single social gathering would have an impact on the likelihood of the person who gathered getting COVID-19? That's like an important question for policy people. It's an important question for epidemiologists who are trying to model how interactions between human beings lead to further growth of the disease. The insight that we had, or the problem that we recognized, was that this is a hard question to study because people who tend to gather socially may be different than people who don't. And so if we see differences in COVID-19 rates between those who gather and those who don't, how do we know that that's because of the decision to gather versus all the other things that they may have decided to do or not do, like wear masks or go to bars or restaurants, whatever it may be. Second problem is you need data on people who are gathering and not gathering, and then you have to link that to whether or not they got COVID-19. All of these things are challenging. And the kind of idea that we had, which I thought was somewhat clever, was let's look at people who have birthdays. So let's look at insurance claims data, where we have data on millions of Americans. We know in those data when the beneficiary in the health plan has a birthday. And we just look to see whether or not rates of COVID-19 go up in the 2 weeks following the birthday among people who had a birthday compared to people who didn't have a birthday. And the thought is that people who have a birthday have a particular reason to celebrate sometime around the date of their birthday. And that's something that we can identify in large data. And we can identify the consequences of potentially gathering, and that's COVID-19. And so what we found was that rates of COVID-19 go up quite a bit in the 2 weeks following an individual's birthday. We looked at whether or not that varied based on the politics of the county. So maybe you'd think that in red counties of the country, that that effect would be larger. Turns out it's not. So both in blue areas and red areas of this country, people are gathering for their birthdays, and that exposes them to greater risk. So it's not a political thing. We looked at whether or not certain milestone birthdays have a larger effect. So maybe it's like the 30th birthday or the 40th birthday or a kid's 16th birthday has a bigger effect. No real effect on milestone birthdays. One thing that we found that was interesting was that child birthday seemed to be important. So if the household has a child who has a birthday, that leads to a much more dramatic, a larger increase in COVID-19 in the household in the 2 weeks following than if the household had an adult birthday. So this is kind of a fun exploration of a question that kind of met two criteria. It was, I think, informative as to some, you know, something about the pandemic, but it also kind of falls in my wheelhouse and interest of being just fun and creative use of large data.
Yeah, no, sounds like a fascinating study, and I'm excited to see it once it comes out and read a little bit more about it. Sounds like, at least how you explained it, a really complex problem to tackle. So at least the creative lens that your team took is it's like pretty exciting in of itself. So Dr. Jenna, I want to ask as well, you know, some of the changes that have been imposed by COVID in the health information technology space, I imagine that a lot of data has been created. There's a lot more use of the electronic health record and telemedicine. What do you think is going to stick around?
My guess is that the changes that we've observed with respect to telemedicine are probably going to stick around. I think providers recognize that it's quite valuable to them to be able to have more flexibility in the way they provide care. I'm sure for patients, for certain types of care, certain types of visits, they're going to recognize or already recognize that they probably didn't need to be seen by a doctor. So I think we can expect to see an expansion in that sort of care, telemedicine care. We might even see substitution of some in-person visits as well. I'm sure people are going to be studying what's the effect of greater telemedicine access and use in the future on quality and cost of care. I mean, there's no doubt people are going to study that. You know, the type of question that would interest me is to say, well, what happens if we keep patients outside of doctors' offices because of telemedicine? Are they less likely to get hospital acquired infections, spread disease? And those are the types of things I would think about as being kind of fun and interesting to study. As far as electronic health records, I don't know that the pandemic will necessarily have had a huge effect on how EHRs are used. I think that the biggest place is going to be really in telemedicine.
Okay, great. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And just right from there, keeping people out of the hospitals, nosocomial infections, I wonder what that impact will be. So hopefully someone studies that and I can read about it one of these days. So Dr. Jenna, as a future physician, how do you see the future of health information technology in 10 to 15 years when I'm practicing?
I think it's going to be different, and it'll probably be different in a few ways. So one is that I think it'll be able to help your practice as a doctor more than it's been able to help you to date. And to be clear, I think it's been incredibly helpful. I mean, there's no doubt about that. It's a revolution compared to, like, say, 15 years ago. But I think the development of predictive tools that leverage in real time electronic health record data probably can be influential to physician decision making in the real time. So when you see a patient in the hospital and you're making a differential diagnosis, perhaps there would be a tool that would, you know, automatically query the EHR, including labs, notes by consultants and other physicians, and then provide differential diagnoses that you hadn't considered. That's kind of maybe something that's a little bit further afield than the current applications. We could totally see something like that happening and I think well less than 15 years. I think there's already a lot of exposure of researchers to electronic health record based data. The harder question has been to date is how to kind of curate that data in a way that's analytically tractable for researchers. And already there's a lot of headway that's been made in that space as well. So I think for a lot of reasons, we can expect EHR data, health IT to kind of continue to affect the practice of medicine and the way that we produce and use knowledge in medicine.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds great. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Dr. Jenna. Thanks for talking with us today. I want to wrap things up now and ask you, do you have any channels where people can connect with you and follow your work?
Yeah. I'm always happy to take emails from students and people who are interested in the work. I mean, I certainly prioritize students. I was a student not too long ago, and I think it's important to kind of nurture young minds. And I'd be lying if I didn't have a selfish interest in getting people to think the way I think and work on the types of questions I work on. So of course, not as good as me, because I don't want to eliminate my advantage for the time being. But so, you know, I'm always happy to respond to emails. I'm active on Twitter, so I use that once in a while. I'm writing a book, launching a podcast, hopefully soon. So those will be other ways that people can get involved also.
Well, everyone, that's all for today. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your time today, Dr. Jenna. This has been Making the Rounds, a podcast by the American Medical Association. You can subscribe to Making the Rounds and other great AMA podcasts wherever you listen to yours, or visit ama-assn.org/podcasts. Thank you for listening.